Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness, of our culture, the totality of a civilization that seems to be moving, I think, towards a higher evolution. And that's why I'm talking to tonight's guest, Jason Voss, who's written a book called The Intuitive Investor. But if he brings meditation, he brings a lot of the ideas and practices that I've been talking about on this show to the business world. So, Jason, welcome. I'm very happy you're here today.
Alan, it's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, and you know what I like about you is that you are really grounded in the practical world of business and economics, and yet you're so open. I'm surprised how open you are to these, I would say, non-material elements. And for me, I don't see quite how the material world of money and investing really fits in with this non-material world of spirituality and meditation. How do you make that bridge?
Well, first off, a tough question, right?
I'm sorry, do you want to introduce your background first? I should do that.
But. Oh, sure, you bet, not a problem. Yeah. You know, I was an investment manager for a number of years. I had quite a level of success here in the United States. I worked for a company called the Davis Funds, and I managed a fund called the Davis Appreciation Income Fund. And I after having had an epiphany in New York City back in late 2004, I decided to retire in 2005. And I then wrote a book about some of the information that had come out of years and years and years worth of meditation practice as well as business practice. But in answer to your question about how to bridge the material and the spiritual, yeah, especially in a modern context, you know, I spent the early part of The Intuitive Investor talking about this. And for me, investing is the reason we're on the planet. And let me be clear about this, because when people hear the word investing, they think stocks, bonds, mutual funds, real estate, maybe art, maybe jewelry if they're really, you know, freaky or something. But investing is nothing more than making conscious decisions about your life with the resources that you have at your disposal or for your use or borrowing or however you want to put it. And so crossing the street is an investment of sorts. How the route you take to work is an investment of sorts. How you spend your free time is an investment of sorts. How you interact with your spouse is an investment of sorts. And then you also have the more sort of normal realm that people think of investing, which is to forego future consumption. This is the technical definition: forego future consumption for future benefit. And so the way you bridge it is you just recognize that let's make as many conscious choices as possible, which is one of the central themes of my book, and that's how those two worlds are bridged.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, let me see if I can integrate this into my life, into my understanding. Yeah, I think so. Anything you put your time and your attention into is an investment, right?
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. And so it becomes about context. What's the context? What investment are you wanting to make right now? Do you want to make an investment in your future by, you know, going back to school and learning something? Do you want to make an investment in your present by sitting in meditation? Do you want to make an investment in your marriage? Do you want to make an investment in terms of your bank account? You get to choose the context.
But is making an investment, I know it's kind of a philosophical question, about the future and not living in the present? I mean, from that definition? You know what I mean?
That's one of the interesting things about investing is it's all about the future. It's about discounting the future. It's about making decisions now that will have an effect on the future. And, you know, in the spiritual realm, you know, of course, the many spiritual traditions talk about focusing on the present moment. So the question I think you're asking is, uh-huh, how do you reconcile those two
right,
seemingly conflicting things? Well, my own view, and interestingly enough, some of the people who have read the book, who are fans, who have engaged with me in dialogue about it, have said, you know, your book goes down kind of an interesting pathway in which there's an implication in the book. And I'm like, okay, what's the implication? They said, the time is not real, right? And I would tend to contend that that's exactly what I believe. So and let me layer this back into investment context so we don't take what you had hoped probably was a grounded discussion into like an ungrounded realm. Time is not real, but consciousness scales. And what do I mean by that? The book is organized, The Intuitive Investor is organized around four principles. And the first one is infinity, which the next state of consciousness is paradox, which is where the left brain, right brain, or the quantum collides with the Newtonian, if you will. The third state of consciousness is harmonization, where you sort of disappear and you merge with something else. And then the fourth state of consciousness is where we experience time, and that's action, I call it. And there effects follow causes. And I tend to think that the reason that state of consciousness exists, and that's the primary state of consciousness we find ourselves in, is all about learning lessons, right? If the world were ordered differently, we couldn't learn anything, because when effects follow causes, our choices have consequences. And when they have consequences, it helps us grow and learn as people. So the question here, like, how do you reconcile the material world with the spiritual world, I think is answered by saying consciousness scales. So the principle one, infinity consciousness, which is the sort of now consciousness, the state of consciousness of no consciousness, encapsulates and includes that fourth state of consciousness, which is the action, effects follow causes consciousness. And that's the realm right there, effects follow causes, where investing takes place.
Wait, let me see if we can break it down just a little bit, because I really want to follow what you're saying, because I think you can help me become more grounded in that world. So the first level, you break your book into four parts. And the first part is what exactly? Can you?
Infinity. And that principle is that the secular version of that is the universe is infinite. The non-secular version of that is God is infinite. And so there's a natural consequence if you believe that. And I state it in the book of, you know, you get into these really bizarre in the modern world and its notions of religion, you get into this very bizarre situation, especially in sort of the more traditional religions like Christianity, where they imagine God outside of self, right? It doesn't interpenetrate self. So because it doesn't include you, that means that God is finite in some way. And that doesn't make sense. How could a finite God create an infinite universe? So the only real answer, if you're going to have a spiritual reality, is you have to believe in infinity of one form or another. And the consequence of that is that you and I are part of it, which means that we're all interconnected as well. We're all part of the totality.
Well, you know what's interesting? That the scientists took that part of religion and saying that, you know, God, you know, the Christian, Judeo-Christian God really doesn't have anything to do with us. It lives outside of us. And they took those ideas, they threw out the God and substituted the Big Bang, and we live now in a godless universe that doesn't have anything to do with us. So, I mean, it's the legacy of that type of thinking that we've inherited through the kind of dogma of science. So,
yeah, that spiritual materialism, that rational determinism.
Yeah, exactly. Is
what you're talking about. And yeah, it's hugely detrimental. So principle one is sort of the ideal state. It's the consciousness of no consciousness. It's, you know, regardless of the spiritual tradition you look at, they all have as a destination that sort of enlightened consciousness with stability, right? It's not just the momentary enlightenment. The Japanese call it kaji, which means a momentary enlightenment. It's stabilized enlightenment where you and the universe are one simultaneously and there's not a differentiation. And that's the goal, and that includes that effects follow causes consciousness, which is the really sort of stepped down consciousness of into the material world where you make investment decisions.
But the whole idea of investment, we'll go into step two, part two, but you know, the whole idea of investment also seems not related to this infinite possibility, because investment to me, and I know it's a limited way, means that there's a limited amount of resources. I mean, that's how I'm interpreting it. That doesn't mean what it is. And if it's limited, then it can't be infinite. And I know there's something about us that's infinite. Do you know what I'm saying here?
I think again, headlong, there are two philosophies, you know, colliding, right? So, mm-hmm. so far you've, I could tell yes. that you like to that one of the ways you think about the world is in terms of continuums, right? And so there
well you brought it up and opposite. I agree with you. Yes.
Things naturally have an opposite, right? But to define a thing and to, you know, draw a fence around it, a mental fence around it, if you will, naturally says it's not these other things, right? Mm. So that's actually principle two, interestingly enough, paradox. And that's the, you know, that's paradoxical consciousness. When you start to try and step things down, you try and understand them, you take them from this infinite sort of beingness, if you will, and you try and step it down to understanding into the left brain, the intellectual mind, you end up with these paradoxical things. So all these things seem paradoxical, but only when you're talking about them with a left brain understanding. So again, you've highlighted two colliding versions of the universe, and one of them is finite resources, which is the logic and philosophy first proposed by the they didn't call themselves economists, but it's like Adam Smith, it's Thomas Malthus, famous of the Malthusian doctrine, for example.
Right.
And all of these thinkers saw finite resources and they saw finite limitation for humanity. And they thought that, hey, let's construct a philosophy around that, which grew into economics. You know, I'm not sure I believe that. I absolutely understand what you're saying. I mean, for God's sakes, I was an investor for a number of years. I have a checkbook and it has a fixed and finite number in the bank account. So I understand what you're saying. The way I tend to think about it is, are you making choices that are in accord with reality? This is the bottom line. And the reason I redefined investing in my book was not to be tricky or to avoid the question. It was to point out to people that investing can be a spiritual activity as well. And that for me, it was when I was a professional. I really believed that. And it's a pathway to personal growth, because if we're here to learn, which I think we are,
yeah,
and effects follow causes, investing provides a natural avenue for that process, and you might do some good in the meantime. So you and I have talked, Alan, before about what that looks like, and ideally the function of investing, right? The what it is, not the profession of investing, not the trappings of investing, which include, you know, IRAs and currency fluctuations and, you know, all that very bizarre kind of stuff. What it really is about is people who have excess resources but a deficit of good ideas for what to do with it, try and find people who have a surplus of great ideas but maybe a deficit of capital or money to be able to make those ideas happen. And the process of financing matches those two people's wants and needs and, you know, puts them together in a relationship, hopefully for the betterment of all, right? And ultimately – that could be about conservation, right? It could be finding a way to do something that humans require, like delivering fresh water to a home, but finding a way to do that in a better way. And that's ultimately what investing is about.
Well, I agree with that form of investing. It's kind of a way of, from what you're just saying there, kind of way of moving infinite resources around so everyone can benefit. But the investing, I mean, that's at least I think that's sort of I interpret what you're saying. But the investing that I've grown up with and have shied away from and is the part of it that seems like gambling on one hand, and on the other hand, it seems like it's not spiritual because there's a limit on it. I guess I asked that before. So those two, you know, am I gambling for my resources and am I thinking that I'm not infinite, you know? I mean, I'm not arguing with you as so much as really wanting to understand and at least break my patterns of thinking of how I look at it. But I'm telling you where I'm coming from, you know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, if I understand you correctly, yeah. you have some doubts that any good can come of it, that it's kind of a superfluous and materialistic endeavor, and you've got some
Yeah, and if there is some good that comes of it, someone else must be losing, you know, which is not fun either, you know? If I'm making money on my investment, someone must be losing on their investment. At least that's the old way of looking at it, you know?
Well, I mean, in this, you and I have talked about this, yeah. And here I risk, you know, alienating some of your audience.
That's
only
okay.
Because of the jargon, not because of the sentiment. The stock market that we all are familiar with, like the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, et cetera, those are so-called secondary markets. Those are used markets, if you will, as opposed to new markets, right? They're new markets for clothes. They're used markets for clothes, you know, like Goodwill. Well, so secondary markets are just used markets for stocks. That is a zero-sum game in the same way that they are for clothing as well. So Goodwill is a zero-sum game. Somebody gave up their clothing and you take it, but few would say that that was a bad exchange. And Goodwill charges a transaction for that, right? Somebody has donated something and they get a tax break for their donation, and Goodwill charges sort of a finder's fee. We've provided a convenient location for you to come get your clothes.
Right.
But when you introduce the stocks, especially in a spiritual community, they have issue with that, or bonds or mutual funds or some other financial asset, but it's exactly the same activity. Somebody finds no more use for the business that they've invested in, they offer it up for sale through a secondary market, the Goodwill, if you will, which is the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ or whatever stock market you're talking about. Somebody buys it. It's exactly the same process. In that way, it's zero sum. But at the primary level, what they call the primary markets, and this is the other piece of jargon, there's primary and secondary markets. Primary markets are exactly as I described. Somebody who has excess capital or excess money, and they don't know what to do with it, meaning they don't have a good idea, and they can find, you know, somebody who has a great idea but a deficit capital, and with that endeavor and that action, they can change the world. And going back to that's a primary market, which is very interesting and very, very obviously in alignment with spirituality and personal growth and some of the themes we've been talking about. In that secondary market realm, it's less obvious, but I would argue that the person at Goodwill who gets the sweater that the other person didn't want, you know, from a very cynical point of view, you could look at that as a zero sum, but you could also look at it as somebody no longer needed something and they offered it up for sale to somebody else. You know, and eBay is, you know, another secondary market for used goods. And yet we don't take issue with it. But the spiritual community, I think because they see a taint in money and motive, taint the activity and function of investing. But the two are different things, right? You could have a person of character acting with, you know, using a function of investing quite ethically, just as you can have an unethical charity.
Right.
So, yeah, I see the real issue here is character, not really the function.
Right, because it actually is an act of empowerment. I think this is what you're saying, to invest in something or somebody and say, you know what, I'm with you. I like what you're doing. I like your ideas. I'm going to help make this possible because this is what I believe can help the world. I mean,
correct. And we might both benefit. And
yeah.
So that what you just said, though, I'd like to put you on hold there for 2 seconds. You know, the way investing is normally done is not that way. You know, I do not think that the investment business is populated with a coterie of, you know, ethical, you know, high-minded people. I wrote the book The Intuitive Investor in part because I saw an opportunity for the way people make decisions to be a pathway towards, one, personal growth, but two, spiritual development in a way to make the world a better place. But it required that people bring their consciousness in accord with reality. And so if you do that successfully, and that's really the principal task of an investor, right? And it's also the principal task of a spiritual seeker, is you want to have your consciousness as in accord with, as harmonizing with reality as is possible, which is the power of now that, you know, Eckhart Tolle talks about and so many of the great spiritual traditions talk about. Well, that's exactly what leads to success as an investor. And then after that, say you're so fortunate as to have brought your consciousness in accord with reality and you're seeing the reality for what it really is and the fabric of the universe and whatever, then you have to be decisive with that knowledge. And that's a separate problem that I also talk about in The Intuitive Investor. But this is how investing it can be a spiritual endeavor is and a vehicle and an arena for personal growth.
Well, yeah, I'm getting it. And I just want to get a little more practical. Did you ever see the show Shark Tank?
I have not. I'm not a big TV watcher, but tell me about it.
Well, it's where these rich guys sit around and someone comes and presents them with an idea. And, you know, someone said, you know, I have this new idea for scotch tape or something like ridiculous. Sometimes it's ridiculous. Sometimes it's like, you know, a new and improved handy wipe, or it's a, you know, it's a new food source or something like that. But it's a very popular show. And then they make proposals to these rich guys on the panel to invest in their company. And, you know, usually these investors want sometimes more than the person who's created these products is willing to get. But then, you know, they'll say, well, we'll give you this much if you give us this much percentage of the company. And it just seemed like that that kind of investing, which I guess is a lot of how it happens, is sort of a struggle. It's not, I mean, it's sort of you know, a battle to maintain. And I do this, and it happens in my own company where people wanted parts of my new realities, where this is what they put in. So I you know, I don't want to be at war with the world. I want to be at harmony and flow. And is there a way of investing where it is a win-win-win for everybody? I guess you've kind of been saying that, but do you know? I mean, it's like you're putting energy into something, and I am you're benefiting, I'm benefiting, and everyone who's like gets this new service is benefiting. But I think I'm just asking: is there a way where it doesn't have to be so hard, or maybe it's not hard? But I see it as a sort of a difficult road. Maybe that's just how I'm seeing it. But do you know where I'm coming from?
Yeah, I mean, again, it sounds like if I'm understanding you correctly, you're talking when you use the imagery tug of war. Again, you're seeing a conflict between buyer and seller, and I think what you're really talking about and what seems to disturb you is that there seems to be an asymmetry that some people are winners, some people are losers.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean that's a tricky thing, and it's tricky maybe for a reason that maybe the audience hasn't considered. It's tricky because there's a conceit there, and a fatal conceit, as far as I can tell, which is that some one person has the absolute transparency and understanding of how both people benefit or lose in the transaction. So going back to the, you know, you sell your sweater, offer up your sweater to charity, to Goodwill, and somebody else comes along and buys it. You know, depending on the context of the observer, they may absolutely see that the person who gave up their sweater lost because the person who buys it at Goodwill for the cheaper price, where the first person bought the sweater for much more money, they see the benefit and the big smile on the face of the person who got the sweater, and they see tragedy, right? They think, oh my goodness, this person has absolutely literally pulled the wool over, you know, somebody else's eyes. Whereas somebody looking at the transaction from another side with another context says, oh no, that absolutely benefited both parties. So I can't address the question because I can't address everybody's context and what their preferences are. My preference is, as an investor, to look for opportunities in which the greater good is served. And by greater good, I'm including myself in that. That's my principle one of infinity, which is I'm a part of the totality as is everybody else. And if I'm making decisions where there's mutual benefit, I tend to think that those are good decisions. The second thing I want to say about this, because this is an important thing, part of spiritual development is – and this is I've dealt with this question many times as a teacher of meditation too. People have a deep-seated preference that the world looks a particular way, right? That and that way is peace and harmony and delight, and you know, maybe it's whatever people's preferences are. I tend to think that life is much more like surfing than it is like, you know, going to the candy store and getting all the candy, which I think is the former category. You know, sometimes when you're surfing, you fall off the board, but you learn how to be a better surfer from it. You can't determine the waves, but you can determine how you deal with the waves. And investing is a lot like that too. And so my point is that sometimes you're going to lose, right, in investing, but to judge it, that is a bad experience. And while and to label it as that, I think misses the point of this wonderful opportunity to gain transparency or insight into how the world is really operating and really working. And so take it out of the realm of investing, you know, that we tend to think of capital and money, and just take that the value judgments that exist in the spiritual community around that, and instead talk about investment of, you know, in your most intimate relationship. That could be with an employer or an employee, could be with a spouse, a brother, a sister, whatever the relationship is. Sometimes, you know, they hurt your feelings because they tell you the truth, but that doesn't mean that there isn't value to that experience. It doesn't mean that it wasn't sort of intended. And it's attachment that creates oftentimes the abrasion, the sense of an abrasion. So now scale that back up and let's go back to the realm of investing in capital the way we tend to think of it. Who's to say what people really experience? And is how can we definitively say that there's abrasion? So that's my question for the audience, and my question for you. If somebody states that they're experiencing abrasion, that's a different thing. But I think it that whole line of thinking assumes that somebody knows what's right, and that somebody is me. And I don't know that I know that. I really don't.
No, I appreciate that's a really honest personal expression, and I appreciate you coming from that, because you're not coming off as like, you know, which a lot of, you know, you talk to investment people. I mean, I want to get beyond this in the discussion, but you talk to a lot of investment people and they come off as if they know. And sometimes you know, sometimes you don't know, sometimes, and I think this is where the intuitive part goes. You follow what your intuition tells you, what your feelings tell you. But there's one place you address, how do you get over the fear? So let's say you want to invest, but you know, maybe this is a small fortune that you've accumulated over years of putting it away, and there's an opportunity for investment, and yet the fear says, you know, if I put all my money in there, I'm going to lose it all, or, you know, and I've worked so hard for. There's that fear sometimes on the other side of investment. How do you help people through those situations?
Yeah, thanks, Alan. Yeah, this is a critical question, because again, if the job of the investor or the spiritual seeker is to bring their consciousness into accord with reality, you know, to minimize distortion, what that means is you can't have emotions clouding your vision. And I tend to think of emotions, and I write about it in the Intuitive Investor, that emotions are a sensation experienced but immediately related to a preference of some sort. So I give the example in the book of you want to go for a walk. You have an intuition of, hey, it would be great to go outside and go for a walk. And here in New York City today, for example, it was really rainy in the evening. And the question, you look at the thermometer, and the thermometer says it's, you know, 40-something degrees Fahrenheit, and it's going to rain an inch in the next hour and whatever. Notice I haven't added any value judgments. I've intentionally chosen language that's temperature or whatever.
Yeah, you made an observation without evaluation. Yes.
That's correct. Yes. There may be people, though, in the audience who have immediately jumped the gun and said, oh, that sounds like a miserable moment to go for a walk, right? Because, oh, it's 40, and 40 when it's raining is miserable, especially in New York City, which is a concrete wasteland, and, you know, there's no trees and grass or whatever. But then there may be other people in the audience saying, I love those kinds of walks. You know, New York in the rain is beautiful. I had an experience like that once when I was 23, and it was great. Either way, it's taking you out of the moment.
It's putting a value on, yeah.
Yeah, it, out of a sensation felt. And right. The felt is the intuition. So anyway, with the fear and anxiety, I make a distinction in the book. Anxiety, I don't think is a the distinction between fear and anxiety for me is anxiety is the kind of thing we've just been talking about, which is a sensation experienced but related to something else. So that sensation may be your intuition says, hey, be cautious here. And you immediately jump without really sort of realizing it with any sort of awareness. The last time I did something like this, say invested in the XYZ company, which I've just invented, the XYZ company, I got burned. Mm-hmm. And that's anxiety. Fear, on the other hand, I would say is a pure, clear, communicative signal of, oh my God, I have to pay attention here. There's something noteworthy. And it's actually a stark reality consciousness. And some people have experienced this probably who are listening to us. If they've unfortunately been in a car accident and everything has slowed down and people report, for example, in a car accident, I don't know how, but I took my seatbelt off as the, ceiling of the roof of the car was being crushed and I ended up in the back seat and the whole thing seemed to have taken hours. That state of consciousness is a fear state of consciousness. And I teach people in the book to be able to tell the difference. If you're in fact experiencing that, and I've only ever experienced that real fear a couple times in my life, that is a sense from your intuition that you should absolutely pay attention to. If, on the other hand, you find yourself relating an experience, a sensation rather, to experience that has nothing to do with the present moment, in all likelihood, that's anxiety. And so there are exercises I share in the book about how you can overcome that anxiety. But I think that anxiety is a very deleterious emotion when investing, as well as in spirituality.
Well, they call what you've just described in remote viewing, which is, sensing things at a distance, the difference between a signal and a noise. The signal is truly the target you're looking for, and the noise is what your mind creates and interprets around it. It's also what a lot of psychics do. They get information, and then they interpret it based on their own experience. But if you just get the sense, the feeling, that's the signal. And I think that's really what you're saying here. Tune to the signal and don't let the old stuff override some basic intuitive sense.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You summarized it better than I did. Thank you.
Well, I've been practicing that. I'm also teaching people remote viewing in the sense of, and I guess it's sort of what you're doing. You're teaching people how to intuitively feel what the situation is. And let's talk about that then, this creative aspect in that you talk about in the book, how creativity is really an essential part of this. So, talk about how you define that and how you use creativity in these kind of circumstances.
Yeah, you bet. All of these things, the intuition, the creativity, powers of manifestation, which is also a theme in the book, they really are all entered most naturally through what I'll call a meditative state of consciousness. And this is sort of that from that unitary consciousness where the apparatus of the ego sort of disappears and recedes in the background and you're experiencing signal. So within that framework and that understanding, what's creativity? Well, I tend to think there are a couple forms of creativity, and I think it's one of the most misunderstood topics that's sort of part of the popular culture. It's become sort of archetypal. People say, oh, I have a friend, she's really creative. And what they're really saying is that maybe she plays guitar or sings in the opera, or maybe in fact that she is conventionally creative in the way that we normally think of it. Maybe, she paints well or whatever. But that's not really creativity per se. Those are creative activities. The activity is the result, though, of the creative process. So what is the creative process is really the essence of it. And I tend to think
– Well, I just want to also say that I think we're all creative. You wake up in the morning, you put on – a shirt and clothes, you have some sense, everything that comes out of your mouth is an expression of creativity. I think creativity is undervalued and, it's everywhere. It really, truly, truly is. So anyway.
Yes. You're the first person I've talked to ever, actually, who agrees with me. I all of this is creative endeavor.
Absolutely. There are moments when you get visions or downloads, whatever you want to call it, where your, you know, time sort of stops and you are, in a sense, someone giving you dictation in your head, and that's like a creative epiphany. But, you know, that's, you know, but each moment it can be lived that way in a sense, you know.
Totally agree. So the forms of creativity that I talk about in the book, there are a couple. One is what I'll call permutations, right? This is where something that you experience, you have an aha moment, and that aha moment is you connecting together different parts of your knowledge that you never connected before. So it could be that you know, you're in therapy, for example, and your therapist says something to you like, you know, why do you let, you know, so-and-so talk to you that way? You know, maybe the next time that that happens, you indicate that that person is bothering you, whatever. And while you're revisiting whatever your therapist has shared with you, your spiritual, you know, teacher or whomever, you know, has related this piece of wisdom to you, you immediately recognize, oh my God, I've been repeating this pattern my entire life. Mm-hmm. I would call that an indication or that's a creative process that you've gone through there. You've connected disparate pieces of information in a way that you never did before for new insight. The other form of creativity, which you sort of alluded to there, is that total eureka moment by which you have instantaneous transmission of the truth from whence, who knows where it comes. I mean, I have my own suspicions, but it's not necessarily related to any real knowledge you have at the time. And I'll give you an example. Isaac Newton, who among describing his, you know, four motions, he also invented the mathematics of calculus, mm-hmm. is reportedly he had a flash and an immediate creative insight or intuitive insight, if you will, into what the calculus was, but it took him 2 years to develop the mathematics to describe it. Mm. So that creativity, which is the radical context break as opposed to within context, is also a form of creativity. And both forms are valid, and both of them are facilitated by meditative states of consciousness.
Yeah, let's talk about, I guess it can also get into meditation in general, getting to those states, practicing those states, of these alternate consciousness that is so accessible to us once we just choose to focus on that, you know? So talk about the different states, yeah, and meditation.
Well, you know, I'm not quite sure what you're after there, but
I'm after is, you know, we have an ordinary state of consciousness, you know, that puts us in a beta state, if you want to call that. And then we have these altered states that tap us into other realms of being. And that's sort of what meditation does. And we really, in some sense, live more in that world than we do in this left brain world. I guess we can talk about it in that terms, left and right brain. Even.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you're talking about, you know, the different meditative states.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you and I have talked about this again, Alan.
Yes.
You know, offline, there are really literally thousands of pathways to that state of consciousness. So to generalize them sort of diminishes and does a disservice to the states. But nonetheless, I'm going to do it anyway.
Oh well, okay.
you know, there are three main forms of meditation. There's focused. Like a pointed focus. So that's like a mantra meditation or a meditation where you focus on your breath. And the idea there is by focusing on one activity, a couple things happen. One, you gain the ability to re-control or take the power back from what you know many meditators call the monkey mind. So you gain a certain discipline. The other thing it does, and you know, sweeping the floor, doing the dishes are other forms of meditation. In fact, some of my favorites. That's a focused meditation as well. What it also has the benefit of doing is giving the left brain something to focus on that's slightly different enough that it occupies itself so that that witness consciousness, that meditative consciousness, that heightened state of awareness can come to the fore of our awareness where so frequently for many people, it's kind of hidden in the background. It's there patiently waiting. It's kind of like a timeless consciousness. It's waiting for the sort of monkey mind to sort of settle itself down. So focused awareness is one. The next is like an open awareness as opposed to focused awareness. And open awareness is takes the form of like a traditional mindfulness practice. And that's one where you just notice the thoughts as they arise in your mind. And you don't judge them. You just sort of notice them. Some practices suggest you label them so that you can begin to map the mental states that you hit every day. So you might be sitting in meditation, you know, in your meditative repose, you know, on your zafu and zabaton, because all modern activities have, you know, the proper equipment. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so you might be sitting there, and a thought that may arise is, hey, tomorrow when I get to work, I've got to send that email to somebody.
Right.
And rather than judging it and experiencing the emotions of that and taking it personally and then going way off track, you simply notice, acknowledge the thought. You might label it email, right? Or you might label it for tomorrow or something along those lines, and then you let it go. And then you continue to track your mind wherever it goes, and you're actually, instead of redirecting your mind to a focus, you're doing that. The third principle form of meditation is it's like creative visualization. There's not really a good secular description of it. The people who practice it in a non-secular, in a truly spiritual way, call it deity yoga, which is where you're attempting to harmonize with something else so that you become that thing. So you might do a meditation where you focus on white Tara, for example, and white Tara has certain characteristics that you try and emulate. And so you're meditating on the characteristics of white Tara so that you can understand it. And hopefully, if you can enter a surrendered meditative state, you take on the qualities of white Tara and they become inculcated into your personality and your being. So how does all this relate back to investing in the states of consciousness that we've been talking about? I would label that focused awareness as well as the open awareness as like paradoxical states of consciousness. They're ones where there's a separation in your mind between the meditative state and the sort of normal waking state of consciousness. You described it with brain waves. And the harmonization consciousness, which is my principle three in my book, is really like the deity yoga, and that's where you're trying to harmonize with the qualities of something until you become it. How do you relate that to investing? Well, if you're trying to understand a decision you're about to make, go back to school, take a new job, move to another city, divorce the person you're in a relationship with, marry the person you're in a relationship with, whatever your big investment decision is, and notice I've removed it from the realm of money again because I tend to think of it that way, you begin to harmonize with it. You make a choice at the outset, which is the action realm of consciousness, my principle four, where effects follow causes. You make a choice. That's the realm of choice. I choose something, there are consequences. So you choose something, then you choose to harmonize with it. Like, huh, I want to understand this decision as closely as possible. I have to become one with it. I really need to surrender to this thing. There's going to be a moment where you and the object of that you're trying to understand are separate. That's principle two, paradox. Principle one, infinity, ideally you eventually merge with that thing and you get the meditative understanding. Notice that the four principles of consciousness that I've described are the very states of meditation that you enter into, but run in reverse.
Right.
I
just wanted to get I don't think I integrated the first stage. The second stage is sort of being the observer. The third type of meditation is being kind of merging with essences of the divinity. But the first phase, I didn't quite get. Can you repeat that first part of the meditation?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure. We began the interview talking about, you know, how you could integrate spirituality with the material world.
Yeah.
And I said that, you know, I started with principle one because it's infinity. So by definition, it encompasses everything, including, you know, people's bad behavior and, you know, unfortunate consequences.
Right.
But then principle four we talked about, which I said is, for me, I call it the action principle. It's the state where you make choices and their consequences. I said effects follow causes.
Right.
So the outset with meditation, you have to make a choice, and you said it yourself. You said you choose to practice meditation. You can't avoid choice at the outset. That's a peculiarly human thing. We have to choose. Mm-hmm. And I would argue ultimately that the real destination of a spiritual practice is to lose your choices, that you just surrendered. And so you're in a natural state of harmony with the universe, and your choice and the universe's choice are the same. But I haven't achieved that. I've had moments of achieving that.
Is that the first level of the first type of meditation that you're saying, that kind of being at one, that harmony with creation?
What I was explaining is that, you know, these states of consciousness we all experience, right? Yeah. So we all have the material world that we're experiencing. You and I are having this conversation back and forth, and, you know, I'm listening to you and you're listening to me and the audience is listening. That's sort of principle four, right? That's the action principle. Effects follow causes. So I say something that causes you or leads to an effect, and that effect is you respond in a particular way, what have you. But then there's the harmonization state, and you and I can feel it, have experienced the harmonization state several times where we're both simpatico and we totally understand what's happening. That's another state of consciousness. Then there's a paradoxical one, which is where you're trying to define something, and a couple times in the conversation you were talking about this paradoxical thing where you're like, well, I get what you're saying, Jason, about infinite consciousness, but investing to me looks like, you know, it's about materialism and blah, blah. And then principle one, infinity, is the other state of consciousness. If you run those backwards, you have that's the meditative process. Principle four is you choose to do something, which is three, harmonize with something I'm trying to understand, which then leads into principle two. I'm not going to understand it at first. My left brain's going to be fighting with my right brain. The left brain is very analytical. It tries to define things. It tries to step them down into limited understanding, single-pointed understanding. The right brain resists and says, no, it's so much bigger. It's so much grander. And when the two merge and the left brain and right brain sort of surrender to one another, then you have principle one infinity. So what I was saying is that your question about meditation is about states of consciousness. And it's a process of scaling up through these different states of consciousness, ultimately to connect with something at the end. And so as it relates to investing, this is exactly the same process you're trying to go through. You find yourself in a material world. You're trying to understand what to do with your life, what to do with the limited resources at your disposal. You try and seek to understand it through harmonization. Like, I'm trying to understand this investing thing that this guy Jason Voss is talking about. I'm trying to understand his book. I'm trying to harmonize with him. But I'm experiencing paradox. I don't quite understand quite what he's doing. I'm not quite in sync with what he's thinking about. That's principle two, paradox. Aha, I got it. Principle one, I understand. So all of these things are interrelated with one another. And so you can't escape, like, the spirituality and the investing, they're all the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to address particularly that I think it was number two where, you know, you're watching the thoughts. Oh, you're supposed to send someone an email. Now, if we can do that, if we can be the observer of our thoughts, which I think is principle two, then we realize that we're not our thoughts and we're not the programmed impulses of reaction either. We're the infinite observer, if you want to call it that. We're the being that stands outside of time, outside of space, outside of cause and effect, outside of investment even. We are the observing consciousness, and we go deep enough into meditation, at least that's my experience, we realize that all these actions were aspects of a personality that's just limited in time and space, but that's not really who we are. And in a sense, investment or non-investment, or maybe investing in those states itself, seems like the only goal. You know what I'm saying? The ultimate.
I absolutely do. Yeah. I agree with you 100%.
So where does, if you reach those states, where does investment and business and, you know, all that fit in? Because you're teaching this to businessmen, and if they reach that state, I mean, maybe they realize they don't need the business, or you know what I'm saying? So what do you
–
how do you I guess it's that same question I asked in the beginning. How do you bridge that infinite state of consciousness with the limited finite world that's looking for meaning and investment and business and opportunity and all that, where in essence it really doesn't mean anything?
It does, though.
Okay,
that infinite state of consciousness includes those, the fumbling and the tragedies and the glories, and it includes the petty pursuits, and it includes the epiphanies, and it includes all of those things. Mm-hmm. And you can only see them as separate if there's a value judgment involved there. And what I'm saying is that principle one consciousness, that infinite consciousness, that state of oneness, it doesn't exclude those experiences. It doesn't, because it doesn't include it simultaneously includes and doesn't include those judgments. So the activities and the endeavors of people are just as perfect at the same time they're imperfect. And this sounds bizarre, and this is, you know, it sounds like a koan that I'm talking about here.
No, I get
that's
it.
The nature of that state of consciousness.
Actually, it doesn't really sound like a koan. I think what you're saying, and you could say it in what I would say is that God, if you want to call it, God is all things. It's the good, the bad, the ugly, the loss, the gain, the comedies and tragedies. It's all those things. And to get a really infinite view of the source, which is why we incarnated into these bodies in the first place, is to watch it all, to see it all, to experience it all.
And, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the reason I wrote this book, The Intuitive Investor, is because I realized in my investment career that the skills that made me a successful investor were identical with the skills that make you a spiritual seeker, more successful, I hope, successful seeker. Excuse me. And
explain that. Explain what you mean by that statement, that the skills that you had as an investor makes you gives you the same skills as a seeker.
It's the same thing that makes it's the same thing that makes for a successful painter or a successful dancer or a successful spouse or, you know, in a tantric state with your partner.
What's the secret?
Yeah, the secret is to harmonize with reality and right. not sort of be out of harmony. It's to be in lockstep. It's to be surrendered. It's to be experiencing simultaneity with the moment. It's being in the present state of awareness. These disciplines are all united. And that's why when we began the interview, I made sure to define investing as simply to make conscious decisions. And by conscious, I don't mean limited consciousness. I mean, you're making decisions which you can't escape in the material realm unless you're in that one-pointed state, but you still chose to get there unless you have really stabilized your meditation, which I've never met a person who is that. And I've met Amma, for example, who many people hold up as a saint. And even she says that's a... Even she says, you know, there are times when she feels, you know, out of touch, you know, with God. So we're talking about a very rarefied state of consciousness here where a person is, you know, 100% of their time completely in alignment with that sort of universal consciousness. But anyway, go ahead.
No, what I think you're saying before you said that stuff about Amma is that, you know, is that we are in this world to take action. It's what Krishna says to Arjuna on the battlefield in the Bhagavad Gita. And he says, you know, any action I take will have consequences, Arjuna says, and it's like, you know, he says it's like killing my enemies will have its karmic consequences. And then, you know, I think Krishna says, you know, we're here to take action, we're here to be in the world, and we're here to create cause and effect, have consequences, but let's take the best action possible and sometimes
exactly,
but we're here to take action in this. We've incarnated to take action.
You just nailed it. That's the intuitive investor. So that skill set that you just described is universal and it's timeless, and it's the same skill set that makes you a great investment decision maker in the realm that most people think of as investing, which is money and capital. And so I wrote The Intuitive Investor because I realized that was the end goal, and it's the same goal. And you raised a very interesting point that we didn't explore earlier, which is, what if you teach a business person to do this and they walk away from their career? Well, I would say hallelujah, not because they made a choice that I myself made, but hallelujah if, in fact, that's what's in their best interest. If that's what their is best for their spiritual growth, and that choice is in accord with who they are and what they feel in the very fiber of their being, I think that's a great choice. And that may be a consequence. That may be the investment choice they make is to walk away from it all.
And that might be their investment, you know, because you're not making a value judgment on investments, right?
That's right. That's right. So that's the point of this book, is to transcend these limited definitions of what it means to make an investment decision. And so, you know, I was a frustrating interview for the business press when this book came out, because they'd say, well, so what are your favorite stocks right now? And I'd say, no, you're missing the point here. The point here is, all the decisions you're making are investments of a kind, and you need to bring as much awareness to those decisions as you can. One, because they're great avenues for learning, but also because it brings you into accord with the divine when you do so. And that may be that your investment decision is to walk away from it all. Maybe it's to sell all of your possessions and become to move to India or something.
Become,
you
know, a sadhu, yes.
Yes, but, exactly.
Well, I appreciate you opening up that understanding of investment to much broader than this money economic, and seeing it as a spiritual choice, even not doing something as an investment or a choice, you know, or investing and not doing. You mentioned it in the beginning of the show. I'm just interested if you care to share your personal story. What happened to you? What was the epiphany that you realized? I mean, I don't know if you share this, but I would love to hear it, that made you walk away and that made you come back. I mean, what happened in your life in that personal way?
Well, thank you for asking the question. I begin the book with this story.
Yeah.
It was October 21st, 2004, and I was in New York. I spent my career in Santa Fe, but I was in New York to give a speech to the Union Bank of Switzerland's top selling brokers of the mutual fund that I managed. And I went to a cocktail mixer that evening, and I loathed it. I mean, those cocktail mixers were not my favorite professional endeavor activity. And I decided to cut out a little bit early. I was only there for like 45 minutes. I decided to go back to my hotel room. And for those of you who know New York City, it's the Hilton on Avenue of the Americas where I was. And so I went up into my hotel room and I started trying to visualize the speech I was going to be giving the next day. And there was sort of a hint or a whisper, a kind of a force external to self that said, hey, come this way, you know, follow me. And I decided to trust it. And I kept trusting it, and I kept getting deeper and deeper and deeper into this deep meditative state. And I've been meditating since I was seven, and this was one of the few times I'd ever had that kind of an experience where, you know, there was an invitation from something seemingly unrelated to me to go further. And so I did, and I got this really profound vision of what the world looked like circa, I didn't know, I knew it was within 10 years, but I didn't know the exact timing of it. And that world looked like a financial collapse. It looked like it would probably be real estate related. And that, by the way, was a mental process. I was trying to relate this sort of pure awareness to a mental process, trying to map it. And I thought, okay, it's going to be real estate, because I thought real estate was overvalued. And I also got the sense of, hey, look, people get a vote. We all collectively get a vote, and what are you going to do? And I thought at the time, wow, you know, I've had a very high level of success. I have the ability to walk away from my career and do something else. And you know, this experience really suggested a couple of things to me. One, it was time to get in touch with my masculinity. I was raised by a single parent mother, and you know, that's not a criticism of her, but I didn't have real good masculine role models as a kid. So I thought, okay, that's something that I really need to focus on. And the second was to get over my fear of being alone. And that was sort of like the first milestones and guideposts on a spiritual path. The only way to make that happen was to retire from my career and walk away from the relationship that I was in at the time, which actually was not a bad relationship, but to accomplish that stuff was not going to occur. So the epiphany was multi, you know, and I'm trying to abbreviate it here because realize we're at the end of our time.
No, it's okay. But we can talk a little longer. I mean, we can go a little bit longer. We don't have to finish right now because you can go into a. I mean, if you care to, you know. But I mean, I'm just
So the way, you know, I didn't get real guidance in terms of how to interpret that particularly well. It was really strongly indicated that those were really important for me to learn and to deal with. And so I retired from money management. It took about 9 months to unwind from my career because I had to find a successor because I wanted to responsibly pass the responsibility for managing the fund, the mutual fund I managed, to somebody else so that – I mean I had 15,000 investors. I didn't want to, you know, just walk away because I had had this meditation. So it took 9 months to sort of unwind from that. And then I went to go study martial arts for a couple of years with a guy I'd always wanted to study with. And because I was trying to also crystallize or make more material, make more real my meditation practice to integrate it into my body, not just to have this separate experience where, you know, my meditation is me sitting in a particular posture and I have this experience, but it's unrelated to the movement of my actual body. Yeah, so, you know, many years passed. You know, that was in 2005 that I actually retired. And I started writing The Intuitive Investor February 1st, 2008, after having had a vision that one of the places where I could apply leverage to share what I knew and also to have great effect was in the investment business. I would put the legal profession and politicians in the same category, you know, of needing, you know, people who have some awareness to show up. And I thought it was the time for good people to do good things. Mm. And so I exited retirement. I now work for a nonprofit that does financial education. And, you know, I'm having these kinds of interviews and trying to promote meditation to the financial community and hopefully to get more of them to make more conscious, more aware choices that factor in the rest of the world into their decision making.
Well, it sounds great. I think you're really on track. I think we need a bridge like you because, and you know, business has gotten out of hand. I mean, it's you know, it's something seems off in that world, and we need, on a planetary level, to come back into balance with business, with investment, with all the things that can humanize the world. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with business. I mean, you have a good idea, you put it out there, people like it, and you change the world, right? The Apple computers, look at the iPhone, all those things that started off as possibilities, I'm just talking the modern ones, have changed and made life better for us.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that business, again, as a function, is an innate function. You know, we're all trying to get better or do better, and business is a facilitator of that. It helps make lives more pleasant. I couldn't agree with you more that it's out of balance and it needs to be rectified, and that's the subject maybe of another conversation because right. That's a multi-headed hydra. But quickly, I'll say that, you know, the rational determinists are not helping, and the material realists are not helping, and economics or capitalism as the be-all and end-all of problem-solving is not helping. It's not intended to solve ethical problems. It's intended to organize resources efficiently, and that's it.
So leave us with something that does help. Leave us with that taste of where we can go on all those levels in a way that, you know, will uplift us, if you have anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to sound cheesy, but I would say meditate and trust the experiences you have there. I dedicated my book to people who believe in their experiences above all else, and, you know, unequivocally stated, that's my religion. And I think that too often we question our experiences and we overthink them and we have anxieties about them. And so the intuition is squelched. So all of that to say, trust your intuition.
Just one last question. Is there, what do you want? Is there a thing for yourself? I mean, is there, I mean, you it seems like you have a great relationship. You've been successful in business, you know, you're out, you know, speaking to the world and helping them open up. But what's your personal path? What's your next step for you? Just curious.
Well, for me, what I'm working on spiritually is service. And so, you know, I send my emails frequently, yours, comma, in service. And I've tried to make it the central focus. And it's, you know, it's been a hard one for me. And not just because I came from a business background, that I don't mean it that way, because I didn't think that I was a corrupted human being. So it's not meant to be a countervailing weight against a lifetime of corruption or, you know, Wolf on Wall Street kind of a thing. Right. It's just that pure service where the central focus, the happiness and the joy that comes from serving. And the vehicle that I know best, and Alan, you said it, you know, I'm aware that I could be a bridge between two seemingly estranged communities, the spiritual community and the business community. And so it seems like a natural place to try and serve, and I'm trying.
But is there anything you want for yourself? I know you want to serve, but if you want to share, anything you feel you need or want to accomplish or do for you, just for you. I'm just curious in your process.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. I mean, that's pretty good.
That is great. If that's
I'll say, I'm married and I'm very much in love, and you know, my personal dream is to have launched meditation for the financial community, and such that it has a momentum of its own, and I can, you know, retire into obscurity again.
You really want to retire into obscurity ultimately?
Sure, you bet.
What do you get from obscurity? I mean, what do you get from, I mean, what do you get there? I'm just curious, what do you get, you know, in that retirement? What are you hoping to gain in that retirement?
Spend time with the person I love much more, and get to sleep in every single day, and to decouple one's natural biorhythm from a clock, and all of those really beautiful kinds of things that I experienced when I was in it retired before.
I see. Well, good luck with that. No, I appreciate what you're doing. I hope you don't retire too soon, unless, of course, you want to. And enjoy, because I think you have a great sense of both these worlds. And, I think that's rare. I mean, a lot of people talk about it, and, you know, a lot of people say they're spiritual, but I think you've had real experiences in those internal states. And of course, you've had real experiences in the marketplace. So usually it's one or the other. And it's hard to find people that somehow have had them both in that way.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Well, I hope to serve, as I said, as a bridge. You nailed it. That's really sort of what I'm after right now.
Well, thank you for taking the time here. I've been talking to Jason Voss, the intuitive investor, a radical guide for manifesting wealth. But it's not just wealth, it's your life. It's investing in yourself, in who you are. That's what I would get the sense of here, you know. Right, Jason?
Yes, you're correct. Oh. That's exactly the point and the central thing.
Okay, so how can people find you, reach you, discover you?
Lots of ways. JasonApolloVoss.com, Apollo, like the Greek god Apollo, which is, in fact, my middle name. That's a question I frequently get. My mom's an ex-hippie. So JasonApolloVoss.com, or you can follow me on Twitter. I tweet pretty frequently. I'm at the Intuit Invest, and those are probably the easiest ways.
And intuitiveinvestor.com is a website for you as well. And you give talks and workshops and lectures. You're off to Asia in January, aren't you?
To India and to Vietnam to talk to the investment community about the role of the right brain.
Can you give us a little taste of that? What was the role?
Our whole interview this evening has been the subject matter. I'm going to be talking about the importance of creativity and intuition, and that meditation is the vehicle to unlock those forces.
Mm.
And a natural consequence, by the way, of meditation is that people behave more ethically. There's now scientific research that demonstrates that. So to an investment community, you get them with the catnip of the possibility of greater investment success. But then you sort of in a back doorway introduce this practice, which is demonstrated to make them more ethical.
Why do you think that is? That is a very curious observation.
Because people who meditate can't help but feel a greater sense of interconnection with their fellow human being, such that when they're making decisions, they consider the ramifications of those choices on those around them to a much greater degree. So they don't behave as selfishly.
That is, I mean, I know you said a lot of interesting things, but that is like the most important thing I heard. I mean, it was all good, but there's something in that that I think goes back to kind of the integrity of the soul itself. And where'd you hear that?
There are two pieces of research. One was published by MIT. They have a neuroscience center up there, and the other piece of research, which just came out earlier this year, it's a co-authored paper, and I don't remember the other institution. I apologize if anybody from the institution's on there, but it's the University of Pennsylvania Wharton Business School and some other institutions that co-created or co-authored research study that they did. So there are now two papers that show that meditation leads to more ethical decisions.
Wow, there's a real depth and, in spiritual meaning in that. But anyway, thanks. Thank you, Jason. It was really great. Let's have lunch again soon.
Yes, I would love it. Alan, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to your audience.
Yeah, it's been fun, and I learned, and I'm always learning, and this was a great interview to learn more and to realize that investment is in a sense what we're here to do. Invest in ourselves, in the future, in others, in possibility. So I've been talking to Jason Voss, Jason Apollo Voss, the intuitive investor. I'm Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. Email me at newrealities.com. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.